Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
Welcome to the On Air podcast. I'm your host, Madhir Mehma. As always, excited about another opportunity to highlight fascinating and relevant research at the intersection of AI and global developments. Today's discussion, AI and the economy. To shed light on this topic, I have the privilege to be joined today by Katya Klinova. Katya is the head of AI, labor, and the economy division of the Partnership on AI. There, she oversees, among many things, the AI and Shared Prosperity Initiative, asking how to make AI progress in the workforce more inclusive. Prior to that, during her graduate work, Katya examined the potential impact of AI advancement on the economic growth prospects of low and middle-income countries. She also worked at the UN Executive Office of the Secretary General and at Google. In other words, she has led the perfect academic life, at least the dream one from my perspective. Katya, welcome to On Air.
Thank you so much, Madhir. Thank you for this very kind introduction. Excited to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And that's the least. There's a lot more. I actually had to cut that down because I want to get into the conversation with you, and hopefully in the process, you can tell us about all your globetrotting efforts as well. I know that you were at Harvard, but then you also have a degree from three different universities as a, I think, Globus Mundi scholar.
Thanks to the European Commission and their Erasmus Mundus program.
Yeah. Like I said, as an academic, you have lived the life of an academic, both the private sector, international organizations, academic research. And so I'm sure we'll talk about this and our listeners will want to hear more about how they can also come up and also design their own dream job. Just ask you actually a little bit of a partnership on AI. What is it and what drew you there? I mean, given your, again, journey.
Thank you for asking this question. The Partnership on AI is a coalition of over 100 now organizations. Most of them are civil society, human rights organizations. Also, we have technology companies as well as academic research centers. All of these teams and people are united in the pursuit of figuring out the details, the minutiae of the day-to-day putting responsible AI principles that you've probably seen many of and your listeners have probably seen, you know, a number of in practice in the day-to-day realities of AI development and AI deployment. We organize our work around different areas of subject questions and issues within responsible AI space. So I have colleagues who work on transparency, accountability of AI. I have colleagues who work on safety, developing safety protocols for foundation models that are about to be released in October. My colleagues who work on synthetic media and media integrity. And my part of the SPI is running our AI labor and economy program. So looking at everything that has to do with AI impact on labor, how AI reshapes quality of jobs, access to jobs, and also thinking about the jobs in the AI supply chains, not necessarily the high-paying, usually well-off jobs of within technology companies, but jobs of workers who label data that we then use to train machine learning models.
How do you get there in partnership on AI? As I pointed out earlier, there, you've done different things, you've worn different hats. What drew you to it?
Soon after the Partnership on AI was created in late 2016, 2017, and was starting up, and I was in graduate school, and I was looking at where could I take my interests of around AI impact on the economy and on jobs. And at the time, the responsible AI as a field was just still shaping up. And there were people looking at AI impact on national security, for example. There were, thanks to like really fundamental research and activism, more and more questions around bias and discrimination through AI. But there wasn't a lot when thinking about AI's economic impacts globally, not just for the US, but globally. And at the time, the Partnership on AI had its founding research director of research, Peter Eckersley, who we met with him. And he was really interested in thinking about this question, thinking about them in a global scope. And that was pretty unique. So I found a very happy home for me as a postgraduate school to continue this work and think about global economic impacts of AI in, yeah, within the partnership. At the time, that was a pretty unique place to do that.
Yeah, no, certainly. And you have a background in data science. You got your, I think, Bachelor of Science in that. And of course, and in doing your graduate work, as I mentioned, I think you were at Harvard doing an MPA. You were working on this question of the potential impact of AI advancement on the, as I mentioned earlier, on the economic growth prospects of low and middle income countries. I was first drawn to this question, these questions of AI. I was living in Europe at the time and thinking a lot about countries in the neighborhood of the European Union, thinking about how these developing countries could actually just move from third to fourth industrial revolution and whether AI could provide an answer to that, being early adopters of that. My sense, and actually some of the early research, though, shows that the first mover advantage, usually that's associated with AI adoption, mm-hmm. tends to disadvantage exactly these countries, the low and middle income countries. What does your research show? Is there room for optimism there that perhaps despite not having the first mover advantage, these countries can still benefit from the what's likely to be at least a windfall of profits from adoption of AI?
Yeah, actually, the first mover advantage is not necessarily a thing to chase when it comes to technologies that automate human labor, especially in the context of low and middle income countries that tend to have scarcity of jobs, not scarcity of workers and people in need of jobs, right? And in some sense, like you can think about, well, what is the job of development? Like, what is the task? Of course, it's economic growth, but really, on a basic level for people, how do they feel that their country is developing is that they have plentiful opportunities for gainful employment, for stable, decent jobs. So creating these jobs is the job of development, really. And we've used to think that technology is just like this innovation is this unambiguously amazing thing for development. And like, how much do we need it? As much as possible, when, as soon as possible, where, like absolutely everywhere. And I think I was at graduate school and then during opportune time when like much more nuanced thinking was in the economics field and like development economics field was being developed and discussed around technology, what technology developing countries need, and is AI in its current manifestation, like bringing that. And actually it's not completely, like it's not a very, very new thinking. It's just like it had this resurgence most recently. There is this concept of inappropriate technology being a concept of like, is the technology using the assets you have as a country? If you are a country where, for example, your population is aging, which is the case in many of the rich countries, and your labor force is shrinking and you are experiencing labor shortages, then you are thinking, well, where am I going to get workers? Like you have options of migration. And then if like you, for whatever political reasons, are creating high barriers for migration, then like automation is your answer to that. But then what happens once you create a lot of automation in these rich countries, it starts spreading around the world, including into places where you need to be creating jobs for the young population that is entering the labor force in millions every year. And so you're bringing this inappropriate technology to places where it's jobs that are needed, not automation that is needed. And this is how you fly into like South Africa and you see self-order kiosks at McDonald's. So you fly to Delhi and you see self-check-in kiosks at airports and you start wondering like, why did we automate jobs with this technology here? And that's because once you've invented this technology and it made economic sense somewhere in California, then the fixed cost of developing it is paid and the marginal cost of deploying it all over the world is negligible compared to the initial development. So companies just like put it all over the place and it doesn't matter what the unemployment rate is in some of the countries where they're deploying it or how low workers would be willing to like push their jobs to compete with some of this automation, they just can't, right? Like these marginal costs are negligible. And so these are the questions that really motivated me to work on these questions. And we specifically looked during grad school together with my co-author Joao Breu and my great friend and classmate in the case of Brazil. And Brazil is a large country, a large economy, and we just like acknowledge the gap of all of the, at the time, existed projections that existed around AI's or automation impact on jobs. They were very US-centric. So we wanted to replicate and see what it's going to look like for Brazil. And of course, like none of these projections are perfect in any way or like hold up precisely. But we just wanted to bring this into the discourse to highlight that low and middle income countries are going to get impacted as well, even if they are not the first movers to adopt. And it might be an illusion to think that they're going to be slower to adopt robots, so like they're going to have a lot more time to prepare. But they are getting impacted through these channels of adoption happens in the rich country, and then company just like brings it all over in everywhere they have offices or restaurants or branches.
So I have a two-part question. The first one deals with what you just posited with regards to, are we employment-focused or just economic growth-focused? Given your experience working for Google, but just generally in the private sector, where do most people fall on that question? Because what you've just proposed is not necessarily the received wisdom, so to speak, in some quarters or in a lot of parts, the economic centers of development. So how do you see that debate playing out?
Yeah, I do think that hopefully, if not arrive, but arriving to understanding that economic growth needs to be inclusive. So if you have a growing pie, but really it's just like a 1% or a fraction of 1% that enjoying the majority of that growth, while the wages of people at the lower at the lower end of the income distribution are stagnating, which has been the case in the U.S. up until the pandemic, and then we'll see if actually the pandemic change will continue to hold now in the post-pandemic world or not. We now realize that that's not a great world to live in, because you are creating a lot of inequality, even though your economy is growing and your technological progress is creating fruits, but they're just not shared broadly. And it needs to be a different growth that brings that genuinely lifts all boats. And that is not a growth that's guaranteed with any policies or any technological change. It does not happen, quote unquote, automatically. And I think maybe the globalization was a lesson here. It was just this unambiguous, it's going to benefit the size of the pie to open up to trade. But then we saw that entire communities were basically decimated, and the kinds of consequences that brought to them was rising rates of addiction, divorce, deaths of despair and suicide, right? So it's really, really profound consequences of jobs disappearing in entire regions or entire towns. Yeah. So it used to not mean that economic growth needs to be creating jobs and be inclusive, but I think people, it's a much more shared notion now that it has to be this way. Otherwise, why are we doing it?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. Let me ask you the second follow-up to that, and that is with regards to, because you're saying, okay, so there's no need to rush to be an early adapter. You don't have to pay the cost of developing these kind of technologies because other countries will do so, and then they'll just, wait. It won't trickle down. It has a political connotation to it, but some of this will be adopted in these countries, perhaps on the first wave, but certainly second and third. Some would argue that if you wait around for that, A, that may never happen if you're not a big market or a very profitable market for these kinds of economies. And so as a result of that, you perhaps may miss out on huge profits from that. And of course, we could say that it's not just about economic growth, but certainly economic growth does provide at least the resources to governments to provide for basic services, government services for their economies. And again, looking at Eastern Europe, the problem with most of those countries is actually loss of labor force. And I know that especially in the service sector, there isn't enough labor force. But then in a bunch of other sectors, agriculture would be one area that automation would be welcome because most of it is subsistence farming rather than big cooperative stuff. And that, of course, leads to declining productivity and doesn't move people out into the workforce in other areas of the economy. And so then you end up with less productive countries. So there is an argument to be made that there is a public good in a way, or there are public benefits that come from early adoption, or quick rather adoption, or at least a focused effort at adopting AI. My follow-up to this, I don't know, long commentary is, how do you see developing countries taking advantage of advances in AI? What specific things can they do to spur economic growth or improve public services or address various societal challenges? What can they do specifically?
Yeah. So your comment raises like a whole bunch of issues. So
feel free to tackle them all, Katya.
I'll try to unpack and do justice. So I think there is the takeaway really from your comment is be selective about where you want to be among the first movers adopting something and what technologies might not be the ones that are appropriate for your particular conditions of the labor market and the labor market needs in your country. Because just as you said, low and middle income countries, this is the majority world. Like there is so much diversity in the needs. And yeah, the situation in Eastern Europe is dramatically different in terms of like workforce and labor market nature than, for example, in the Middle East or in Africa. And so every country is unique. I think the message is to not necessarily think that every single technology is fit for your specific labor market. And you don't need to be a first mover in every single one. Some of them are not appropriate for you, and some of them are better. So at the risk of not trying to give like one recipe that would fit all in terms of like how to use AI, for a lot of countries where there is a need to improve educational outcomes, and this is like truly a learning crisis that spans many countries, this may be the number one thing I'm excited about with like this latest way of large language models, is we are probably as close as we were ever to creating a scalable way to enable personalized tutoring and like teaching at the right level with the help of these technologies. They're not exactly there yet, but like hopefully we can invest into this and emphasize and get this to work. And that would, done right, it could be just like tremendously helpful in this learning crisis, I hope. And then with all the consequences for the training that you're enabling and like the workforce preparation that you're able to do as a country. But also just getting into the conversation about like AI governance and of course the data privacy and data ownership questions are going to be extremely important. And like there are countries that have been tracking this pretty closely and developing both government capacity as well as regulation to pay attention to all of this. And there are countries where it's just like, has not been able to afford to invest in this, but this world is going to catch up with everyone and impact everyone. And the data of people in those countries is also going to be within those models. So thinking about all of these questions is important and urgent. The bigger question is, how do we as a global community think about, okay, well, we might be bringing about like the most powerful and consequential technology of our generation, of our century, what uses does the world need? How do we put it to the use of really solving the most pressing world's problems and helping the most vulnerable populations in the world, as opposed to just like chasing profit opportunities? Mm-hmm. If this is the most powerful technology of our century, like the profit is not the only thing we should be trying to use it for.
Okay. Well, so the next question actually comes straight. It's your question. The question that starts, at least it started the draft article for the newly published Oxford Handbook of AI Governance, where I was first became familiar with your work. But you start the article with a question, which I thought was actually, I think encapsulates a lot of my questions that I have about this particular research area. And so I'll read that question and then just maybe for our listeners, what is the answer that you come up with? So here's a question that you ask. What governance levers can help to ensure that AI does not lower the demand for human labor, cutting off large swaths of the global population from their only source of income? So there's this fear of disentangling away the workforce with the source of income, which would be labor. And there's a fear that you have already expressed that if we just go chasing mindlessly after early AI adoption without asking questions about where it's leading us to, that we may, again, disenfranchise a lot of people from their sources of income. What is the answer? What did you find out?
Yes. So thank you for asking that. I'll answer this question, but maybe to people thinking about, well, why pose this question at all? Because there is this common dream to use AI to automate all human labor and free people to the lives and the lifestyles of their choosing, not having to work. And I always feel like I'm such a pessimist when I have to talk to people who have this dream.
And that's right. Yeah.
Dream or something. That's not a great role to play. But I have to address it before I go into why I even think about this. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, I'd love to have that question answered as well. You're raining in our parade here. I'm hoping one day to automate everything I do, including my teaching, grading, evaluation, and everything else. Perhaps even attending administrative meetings. So why not do that? And so you're raining in our parade where I'm hoping here to automate everything. And what you're saying is that perhaps not so easy. Why shouldn't we aspire to that? Is there something about work and labor that gives us meaning as human beings?
I think it absolutely can be part of this. I do not feel like, without actually making any pronouncements about whether people absolutely need work to live a happy life for their identity, for their sense of purpose. I believe some people probably could be very happy just pursuing something creative in their life without needing to think about how to make it earn living for them. That's a beautiful world in some sense to think about and to dream about. So I hate to rain on the parade, but I a little bit have to. And even if you put aside the question of, are we really able to automate all human work? Mm. There is a question of let's assume we were able to. But right now, for the absolute majority of people around the world, selling their labor, this is how they get income. And this is our only way to really reliably redistribute income and wealth around the world. We do not have a system that redistributes globally, that would be redistributing this windfall globally, and we don't know how to make it robust at generation into generation into generation. This owner of AI or robot would continue to redistribute to people that are not economically relevant, whose labor is not economically relevant. So we would need to solve these political economy, social questions before we really rush into decoupling people's, into automating, trying to automate all human work. So for now, we need to be pursuing AI progress and putting it to the use and to service of people and shared prosperity while protecting access to and quality of jobs for people who still need it, which is the majority of people in the world. So this is why I posed that question in the article. Now, let me come back to your question of what are the levers? If we want to do that, what are our levels? And in the paper, I follow Lawrence Lessig's framework, who says any human activity is governed or regulated by four modalities. There is legislation and regulation per se. There is the market forces. There are social norms, and there is architecture. In this case, that would be architecture and the features of the AI field. So let me try to briefly cover each of these. When it comes to legislation and regulation, someone might think, where can the beginning? The new AI regulation is barely coming out. EU is moving forward. They're the first ones. Everyone else hasn't done very much yet. But actually, that's not true. There is a lot of other regulation that doesn't have AI in the name that still governs and sets up the incentives of AI developing companies and AI deploying companies. And right now, in the rich world, which is dominant in terms of where AI gets developed, these incentives are set up through policies in a way that incentivizes a lot of automation of human labor. So if you think about how we tax investments into software and capital and automation versus labor, we tax labor a lot higher rate. So you don't even need robots that are so good that they're able to replace workers perfectly. you're already making it through taxes very advantageous for businesses to invest in automation. Or high immigration barriers. Yeah, there is an abundance of labor force around the world in need of jobs, but we do not allow people in need of jobs to come to places where there is labor scarcity through immigration barriers. And so businesses in those countries then end up investing a lot in automation. And we already talked about how that automation spreads to countries where jobs are needed, not robots are needed. So there, this is regulation. Then when it comes to market forces, again, like the market forces shaped by this regulation drive towards a lot of like putting AI towards automation as opposed to using AI to solve for some of the like real scarcities that, the world experiences around, for example, access to healthcare or effective medicines or clean energy technologies, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. You could keep going, and there's a lot of like pressing real world issues that AI could be helping with. But instead, we're using our very scarce talent of AI researchers to try to think about like, how do we solve the absolutely artificially created scarcity of human labor, which is not a scarcity if you allow people to move around. Okay, and then there is the norms, social norms and norms within the AI field. And just like the question of what do people consider to be worthy problems to tackle in the field. If you are, say, a young AI graduate, you're entering the field, you're thinking, what problems are going to get me my papers published, and like attention and recognition, etc. And a lot of this, like the leaderboards and the benchmarks in the AI field, they are explicitly connected to chasing and matching and trying to beat human performance on basic abilities like image recognition, like or you know, speech recognition translating to text, like et cetera, et cetera. So it is no wonder that if we build machines that get really good at beating humans at their basic game, then at the end we get like a lot of automation on the outside. And so here from like these level, from these, when you examine these driving levers, you can come up with ideas of like, how can we start reshaping this and responding to this? For example, the US government has like a really great track record of setting up public investments or setting up government challenges to inspire whole new areas of research that didn't exist before. So the government could invest into encouraging more research into how do we complement humans? How do we make jobs more fulfilling, higher productivity, or like, entirely new applications of AI doing something that is like completely beyond human cognitive ability. Like an example here would be protein folding, which is an application of AI developed by DeepMind. They're not competing with humans here. Like this is not even a question that applies, but this is a massively potentially consequential positive development. And then just like recognizing that policies that you've set up, even though they're not called AI policies, but policies around tax regimes and immigration and interest rate, they do create different kinds of incentives for AI creators. So like examining this whole policy space in terms of what bias in technological trajectory it creates and being conscious of that would allow to change those policies in a way that would be like channeling AI towards the directions we actually needed to, as opposed to like where it ends up going because of our neglect of how we, of the policy environment that is already in existence and the kinds of incentives it creates.
So here's a question that I have, at least occurring to me as you're talking about this, which I think points to some, I think, common sense ways of addressing a lot of these challenges that we're having, especially in areas where labor market, where there's a surplus in the sense that there isn't enough employment for the workforce. Do you see anything going on both in advanced and developing countries that gives you hope that in fact we understand the nature of the challenge and that, and we agree in a way what you just articulated? Because what you just made a lot of sense. My feeling is that we tend to just, despite knowing what is the right thing to do from a human-centric perspective, we're so enamored with advancement and moving forward just for the sake of it that we're very quick to abandon, so to speak, any mores and any ethical concerns or even social obligations that we have towards one another in terms of developing technology in the right direction. Do you see anything, any developments that give you hope in terms of moving forward?
Yeah, in some sense, like my job has been to think about like what can go wrong, what are the risks,
yeah.
To rain on someone's parade.
Yeah.
Definitely there are sources of hope. You could just like opening, I was mentioning AI principles, the OECD AI principles that get cited a lot.
Yeah.
Number one thing that they state is AI needs to be developed in service of inclusive economic growth that you and I discussed. I don't take for granted, but also I think moving towards a really firm understanding that this is not going to happen by itself. If we just like take care of all the other issues that AI could create, which are like developed, discussed in the other principles, then this number one principle is going to hold automatically.
Yeah.
No, it's not going to happen. So understanding this and like putting measures in place that like, no, actually like this number one principle does hold up. Seeing more engagement and more involvement of low and middle income countries into this conversation through the efforts driven by UNESCO, other multilateral organizations, the really exciting projects of using AI for social good, for humanitarian purposes, for economic development purposes. And then there is a question of like, how do you scale it? How do you make sure this is not a marginal thing that we do on the sidelines of whatever AI we are developing for profit? This is where the majority of money and attention and energy is going. But how do we make this emphasis on this is a powerful technology and we are thinking very deliberately and rigorously about what needs to put it towards and really investing into this to catalyze and scale this beyond a one-off really beautiful application for some humanitarian.
Well, I guess that's my question is that how do we move beyond the aspiration stage? So we're aspirational about how we want AI to be used. And again, you articulated that, the OECD AI principles. Certainly the EU is far more proactive in that front. Admittedly, my limited exposure to the literature on in this direction, I just don't see a lot of signs of the private sector especially, which is going to be the lead on this. In terms of the adoption of these principles, I don't see a whole lot of that beyond the advocacy space. But I don't see big corporations saying, what, we're going to prioritize employment and labor participation over just some way of automating whatever it is. As you pointed out, McDonald's will distribute and will spread its model everywhere because at the end of the day, it's looking at the pocketbook issues. As a result of that, it's just going to be less concerned with aspirational statements and more with the economic impact of their policies. Do you see any movement? Do you see any meaningful, not just conversations, but implementations of these kinds of principles and these issues that you've talked about?
Yeah, I definitely, maybe I'm lucky because I just get to talk to a lot of the people inside large companies who really they understand the potential and the importance of like decisions that are being made about how to use it and really passionately care about access to the benefits that this technology brings. So like access to this technology but there is a deeper question of a lot of the technology is being developed in the rich world for the rich world needs just because of where and how it's developed. So when we talk about benefiting from this technology, there is definitely a question of what can we do? What are we doing to understand how it can be put towards the right uses and the needs of the world that is not located where some of the largest or leading labs are? And this is about also creating new centers of AI development and bringing, because this is not about people who sit in San Francisco trying to create something for people, you know, on the other side of the world.
Right.
It is bringing people who would be benefiting to the table, to the development process, because like they're the best experts of what would add value, really.
Yeah.
And making the development process and the decision-making process and the stakes shared and more inclusive in that way, I think is a really important step that we're becoming a lot more aware of the importance of it. So that gives me hope. But of course, there's a lot more work to be done to for this really become reality.
Now, we've managed to talk for a while without mentioning ChatGPT. That's intentional because we can't just be overtaken by that, and we probably overdo it here. But let me ask you a question that is, in a way, we'll reference it, but just in passing. When it comes to AI, new developments can actually force us to reconsider previous arguments and also long-held views. And you've been working in this space for a little bit. In a post, and again, I'm going to use ChatGPT as a proxy for all the LLMs. There's a bunch of other ones, but that's the one, at least in the public conscience, that's a little bit, so certainly for our students, the most familiar one, unfortunately. But in a post-ChatGPT release world, what arguments, if any, would you revisit from the ones that you have proposed in your article? And also, has the popularity, but also the, I think, the advances that in LLMs, has that forced to reconsider the way you have approached these questions and these issues?
Yeah, I think there are a few like really powerful maybe lessons or like things that gave me a pause. So I already mentioned the potential, I think, LLMs create for personalized tutoring. And I'm just so excited about it. And I hope this happens. Someone listening, please, please come work on that. There is also a question of just much more broad access to trying this technology and thinking about, like, what does it mean for you? Could you be benefiting from this? Or is it disruptive for your professional livelihood? There is, you maybe know, there is a joint strike now by the Writers Guild of America and the Actors Guild. And these are unionized workers. A lot of workers who are going to be impacted by these technologies and are already being impacted, they're not unionized. But these unions recognize the importance of this. And actually, I was listening to an interview with one of the union leaders, and they were like, I'm so thankful that this was released in the fall of 2022 and not fall of 2023, which would have followed our once every 3 year negotiation of the contract, because we wouldn't like realize that we should be negotiating over this. So just thinking about how do you build enough of negotiating power, worker power, to be at the table and have a say in how these technologies are deployed in your workplace and how they're going to be affecting you is so important. And the moment is now for a lot of professions. And I think this massive release and like massive attention made a lot of people realize this. So hopefully there is going to be more attention paid for it. So like, I think what the revision is the speed of a lot of this. And at the same time, a lot of our questions and thoughts about surveillance technology that a lot of the activists and researchers in the space were worried about it from the point of view of this is like over-surveillance, invasion of privacy, almost like invasion of personhood of workers. But I think what really also is coming into the forefront is that those surveillance technologies do collect data that is later used to automate those workers and disrupt their livelihood. So you can think about customer support agents, for example, and the LLMs that are trained on the data they generate. So the questions of how do we equitably give ownership to the data contribution that workers put into improving these models became a lot more urgent, I think, in the public consciousness, which is, well, I guess there are two sides for everything, but more people thinking about this and being aware that this is an important, not some nerd niche topic, is a good thing.
Yeah. I found fascinating on the topic of the Actors Guild strike. I think it was Netflix's Black Mirror that they had an episode. It was episode one of this new season dealing specifically with this issue of AI and actors and rights and ability to control your own narrative, so to speak. So I thought that was quite rich to have that as a setting.
And then,
it's fascinating. It just foreshadows a lot of these conversations are going right now. It's a really, really good episode. I really enjoyed it and posed some serious questions just generally about copyright and personhood, as you also pointed out, and the ability to just, again, control your own narratives. And it seems to me that a lot of the concerns that a lot of these actors have or writers is, well, once I've given you rights to my likeness or image, how much, what are your limits to that? Can you take that and train a model on it? And then you can just keep producing movies with somebody's face just as a cameo at the end of the day, and then not even ask them for permission on that. So there's a lot of, again, interesting questions there. Let me, one final question. I don't ask this question often, but again, given that you wore several hats in the course of your career, both in the private sector, UN, and as an academic researcher, the unknown unknowns, at least for me, I want to know, what is that don't know that don't know? So what questions are we not asking about AI in the workplace, the economy, that we should be asking?
In the, what has been like the last 6 years, as I was thinking about and working to bring more of attention to AI impacts on low and middle income countries, still, like, there's such a gap in research, like, so much more. This is true about not just this research question, many, many research questions, US data, just like there's a lot more attention on US over Europe. And this still remains the case 6 years later. And there are so many unknown unknowns because we're not looking, we're not realizing to what extent, like, what is the volume of all of these ad hoc exported automation to low-income countries with, like, high unemployment from, and there was a lot of labor scarcity, especially during and post the pandemic in the rich world, but nobody measured this and nobody really, like, fully realizes the extent of those impacts. They're very important. So thinking about how do we put AI in service of the cause of development, there is just an unmeasured amount of unknown unknowns in that, unfortunately. And hopefully we can start moving faster towards uncovering and resolving some of those.
Well, thank you, Katya. And I think, at least for me personally, I think challenging these basic assumptions of even asking economic growth to what end is perhaps a good starting point. But sometimes we take these shared norms or, you know, beliefs about what the economy is about, and there's sometimes we get into a straitjacket and it's impossible for us to think and outside of those traditional ways in which we've thought. I think that's probably a good place to start.
100%, yes. Yeah. And thank you for raising these topics on your podcast and making space for that.
Of course. Well, we're inspired by your writings, so please keep them coming. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And of course, we need to make sure we have you back again for another conversation on the next iteration of your writings and reports, both at where you are and elsewhere. And of course, thank you to all our listeners. As always, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can also find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to join us for the next episode for a discussion, intersection of IR and AI. And until then, stay human.